I have developed a reputation in the church, I think, maybe not so much here, of using songs, country songs, as examples. And I think it was Roy Halladay once asked, where do we get material for sermons? And this was in a ministerial conference. And afterwards, I said, listen to country music. Particularly, this is going to rub some of you the wrong way, the old stuff from post-World War II. Listen to those songs. Listen to the words. It's a deep well of bad information. You know, and they're sweet little songs like Slipping Around. Oh, I remember the good old days when that's all they sang about, slipping around so we won't be found, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of those. My wife and I were listening to a classic country station one time, and she said, that's what we were listening to. That's filth, you know. And today it's a little different. There's one song that sticks out in my mind called, what is it, 18 Years and a Dozen Roses. If you ever hear it, it's by Kathy Mattea, and it's about a guy, get this for filth, who has been driving a truck for 18 years and is getting ready to retire, buy a motorhome, and take the wife of his youth for a grand tour of the country in the motorhome. That sounds pretty wholesome to me. I hope everybody gets to enjoy life that much and has a moment in their lives that's that. And that's something relatively new. And I think of others now, it's not all the time, but many times it's about a guy, how much he loves his wife and his family. They didn't have that back in the 40s that I remember, and I was alive back then, well, for most of the 40s. So today I want to begin with a song. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing to you. You probably, particularly you older folks, and I notice there are a lot of you here, I don't know how many are older than I am, but I just turned 80, I remember back, and I was in radio for over 50 years, on the air. And basically during that time, I was playing country music. So I have a deep well of bad information in my mind. But back in the beginning, when I started, there was a song called People. I don't know if any of you remember it. It wasn't a country song. So I'm violating my principles here. It was by Barbara Streisand, and it was People, People Who Need People Are the Luckiest People in the World. Wow. I thought about that. And of course, I was a loner back then. So I rewrote it to People Who Needs People. I'd rather just be on my own. Well, I think differently now. But we do need people. We need each other. You know, look around the room. We need each other. Look around at the feast. We need each other. And we do have those precious opportunities to get together and to fellowship together. And that's important. Turn to Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10 and verse 24. We'll begin in verse 24. Let us consider one another to provoke one another to good works. We can provoke each other. We can lead each other to do good works. We don't always do that, but we can. We have that opportunity. That's why it's so important that we do get together once in a while. It says, not forsaking, this is verse 25, the assembling of yourselves together as the manner of some is. I remember one man who said, I'm an independent Christian, and stopped coming to services because he was an independent Christian. As far as I know, he's not with us anymore. This was in another area. All the bad examples I'm citing, by the way, are from other parts of the country where I've lived. I tell people I'm a New Yorker by birth and a hillbilly by choice. So here I am. I guess there's another New Yorker here. But anyway, a hillbilly by choice, that's me. So not forsaking like the manner of some is, exhorting one another, you know, helping one another so much more as you see the day approaching. We need each other. That doesn't mean we need to be meddling, but sometimes someone will, you know, see an example, or you can listen to the sermonette again, or at least, you know, have your notes and see how, you know, what Mr. Ott spoke about. I think if he asked for a show of hands for anybody who has persistent problems, here I am, you know, and most of you probably have something like that when we get old. You know, as I don't know if I mentioned it, I have cancer. I have incurable cancer. I have manageable cancer, according to my my whatever you call them, cancer doctor, who I'm going to see this week. But it's, you know, leaves me fatigued most of the time, the medication that I take for it. So we do need each other, and we do have problems that are common to us, or that, you know, you may say, well, I know Mr. Ott, he's had problems, and we've all had problems, and Mrs. Ott has had put up with Mr. Ott. But you can turn to another person and say, well, yeah, how did you handle this? And I remember Spokesman's Club. How many of you were in Spokesman's Club? Any of you men? Oh, there's a few of you. Oh, more than I thought, because so many newer people didn't have that opportunity. And I'm amazed, particularly in Springfield, at the number of really good speakers we have. And a lot of it is Spokesman's Club, because we learn to do that. We learn to evaluate. So we need each other. We do need each other. We can't totally get along. And even if you're in an isolated area, you still, in this day and age, have the opportunity to go online and to see Cincinnati's sermons and services. You can sing along if you want. They have the song service and everything out there. But we do need each other. My favorite word to use in a sermon is this one: however. However, many people leave their church, and I'll use that word, that generic word church, or God's church, because of people. None of my children are in the church. My wife is no longer in the church. My grandchildren are not in the church, but they tend to go to Baptist churches, and they tend to change their affiliation every once in a while. And so I did ask, I think, my granddaughter, why did you change? She said, well, we got a new pastor. I didn't like the new pastor. And that seems to be a reoccurring theme in, I'll call it, churchianity, that the administration changes, the pastor changes. I don't like this guy. I'll go to another Baptist church or whatever. So people leave the church, leave the United Church of God, or was Worldwide Church of God. And then as the years rolled by, we had a change of administration. If you're from Springfield and you don't like the pastor, I don't blame you. I know him real well. But nobody, well, I shouldn't say nobody left because of me, because they probably wouldn't talk to me about it, but which I had to deal with recently. But how many of us would do that? And I'm going to ask you a question a little bit later that I want you to seriously consider, even though I think many of us, probably not in this group, but if we were to go back 20, 30, 40 years, many of the people there would probably, if they were honest with themselves, they would answer the question that I'm going to ask toward the end of the sermon, and answer it wrong. But a new pastor, we find fault in the church and in church leadership. That has caused many people to leave the church. You know, we had a big shakeup in 1995, 96, where we were told, well, Sabbath isn't that important. It's kind of a good idea. And then I remember going to the feast that year, just before that came out. And apparently somebody got the word before I did. And we were at a buffet, and a lady who I'm pretty sure was in the church had gone through the buffet, got her scrambled eggs, and it was heaped with bacon. So I think she probably knew what was coming and was living that life. So sometimes we look at other people. We look at their example. We look at what is said, and we don't look beyond the people. But sometimes we do have corruption among people in the church. And if you've been around any length of time, you've seen that. I've seen it. It's eaten into my family. You know, members of my family said, well, you know, they'd heard stories about Mr. Armstrong. And I always said, they may or may not be true. If they're true, this man must have been Superman to do all that in one lifetime, all that he was accused of. And we had, some of us had dinner recently with Aaron Dean, who was probably closer to Mr. Armstrong on a day-to-day basis than anyone. And he kind of cleared our our thinking on some of that. And I'm not going to go into that. I don't want to spend too much time on that. But the fact that there, yes, there were people who were, remember, he used to travel internationally, and that was fine. But there were a couple of people who wanted him to do that so he'd be out of the country and they could prepare themselves to take over. One was more or less money oriented, and the other was, I think, thought he could do a better job as head of the church, human head of the church, than anyone else. So, however, we do have to be aware that we're not going to fall away because of what somebody does or somebody says. If I leave the church, don't go with me, you know, because I'm not ready to do that, and I'm not setting you up for that. But I'm human, and I don't think it could happen. I don't plan for it to happen. And that's the way it is with you. You're here. You're still here. If you go back 10, 20, 30, 40, I was baptized in 1965. And if you go back that far, you can see so many things have happened, and there's been so many different ways we could go. And y'all are still here, you know, in Cave Spring, Arkansas, of all places. We got lost trying to come down here today, and I know whose fault it was. I like to blame Warren out because he was driving, but I was giving him directions and gave him wrong directions, and we wanted to be here at 2 o'clock so we could fellowship with you for a few minutes before services. We got here at 2:05. So we were 5 minutes later than we wanted to be, but 25 minutes earlier than we needed to be. Turn to John 12 and verse 6, or verse 4. John 12 and verse 4. Then said one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him. This is Judas. Why is this ointment? This woman was anointing Jesus' feet with this apparently very expensive ointment. It sold for 300 pence. I don't know what that is. And why didn't we take that money and give it to the poor? And he said that not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag. He took care of the money. And bear what was put therein. He was a thief. What kind of leader in the church back then would allow a thief to be handling the money, to be in charge of the money? What kind of leader would allow that? Who was in charge back then and undoubtedly knew that Judas Iscariot was a thief? Turn to John 3, 31. John 3 and verse 31. Then they that had seen and heard that he testified, and no man received his testimony, and skipping ahead to verse 33, he that received his testimony has sent his seal of God, that God is true. For he whom God hath speaketh the words of God, for God gives him this by the Spirit, by measure unto him. The Father loves the Son, and has given all things into his hand. Who allowed a thief to handle money in the church? What kind of a corrupt, well, it wasn't corrupt, it was Jesus Christ. He allowed that to happen. And we can see that happening from time to time. And Christ is ultimately in charge in the church. Christ is ultimately the one in charge. So that was, you know, if you wanted to not like somebody because of a poor judgment in administration, well, you'd have to be against Jesus Christ. He allowed that to happen. But he is ultimately in charge, but Satan would like to divide us, wouldn't he? Satan, and we see division in the church. We see division, and we have for decades, as long as I've been in the church. And then recently, within the past couple of years, I think politics has entered into it. I think we all tend to lean to what they would call the right to be conservative, particularly on social issues. But I asked our congregation in Springfield, I asked you, do you pray for Joe Biden? Well, the Bible says we should. We should be praying for those who are in charge of the government that we have. Are you praying? And the response, I think, in a lot of people's minds, maybe some, well, no, he's a Democrat. Well, okay. Are you a Christian or are you a Democrat? Well, both. Or on the other extreme, and I don't think you see this much in the church, but there are those who are, you know, think very much that Joe Biden is right and maybe not going far enough. And you can, I have a button on my car radio. I call it my hate button, and it's talk radio. And if you listen to talk radio, you'll hear a lot of hatred aimed at people who tend to be more liberal. And conspiracy theories that you can't even imagine sometimes. One of my unfavorites is when you see a plane going across the sky and it's billowing out that smoke. That's not just smoke. It's a gas to keep us dumbed down. So people believe that. And maybe some of you do. I don't want to offend you too much. But there are others. Others claim the Holocaust never happened. That Holocaust was a Jewish invention trying to get the United States involved in World War II. So did that really happen? There was a man in the church. He's dead now. He was a World War II veteran, and he was in Europe, and he was one of the first to go into the concentration camps where the Jews were kept. And I would always say, and I can't do it now because he's dead, I say, his name was Mr. Esslinger, and I said, if you don't believe there really was a Holocaust, please talk to Mr. Esslinger, because he was there. He was there. He saw it, and saw it firsthand, and has some stories to tell about it. But, you know, and I did part of my job, probably one of the more successful things I did that I hated the most was doing talk radio. I used to do a talk radio show that was very well listened to, but people kind of knew where I stood and where I didn't stand. And one day I drove my car up. Somebody recognized it to a supermarket, went in and came back, left the door with the windows open, and there was all kinds of literature piled in the passenger seat. And I read some of it and realized that, you know, there are people, there were all kinds of conspiracy theories and that from the right. And that's where I would, maybe most of us would tend to lean, particularly on social issues as opposed to government or anything else. Turn to Luke 22 and verse 31. Luke 22 and verse 31. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you and to sift you as wheat. We are being sifted. Have you seen that happen in the church, particularly some of you old people who've been around almost as long or maybe longer than I have? Have we seen that? Sift means by inward agitation to try someone's faith to the verge of overthrow. I'm trying to think which minister did this. I saw a sermon recently online about the First Peter. There's two books, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, both about persecution, and I haven't read through 2 Peter yet, but he said, read 1 Peter, the whole book, take about 15 minutes, and it's about problems we have within the church that are causing problems in the church. We haven't really been attacked from outside yet. Of course, that will come, and that, you know, we can see that in some cases that we are being tested from within the church now. We're being sifted. Satan wants to sift us by inward agitation. I haven't read 2 Peter all the way through yet, but apparently that's talking about persecution, which will come from outside the church, from government, whatever. And in some areas of the world, that's happening. And he uses people, even in the church, to sift us, to cause us to, you know, not do the right thing, to think the wrong thoughts, to think politically, to think about, you know, COVID. And there are differences there. You know, I'm sorry. I know it's not popular to say in this congregation, but I'm a mask person. I left my mask at home, by the way. I was going to bring it. I always bring it to church. And if one person shows up in a mask, even though I don't need to because I've been vaccinated twice, I could put the mask on and they wouldn't feel as funny about it. But anyway, that has divided us somewhat from what we see in the church, the COVID-19 pandemic. Some people, like my son, who apparently now has it, thought it was a hoax. And he's in the medical profession, and so is his wife. And they, I don't think they've been inoculated yet, but they felt that way, and a lot of people do. Maybe most of you do. I don't know. I know someone who died from it. So I tend to think, well, maybe there's something to it. But I want to look at one example here of division, not in the church, but this was in the nation of Israel. And I want to start in 2 Samuel 14, 2 Samuel 14 and verse 25. And I want to look at this very seriously and very personally as well. The example of David and his son Absalom. And in 2 Samuel 14, 25, we say that in Israel there was none to be so praised as Absalom. He was well thought of for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish found in him. Absalom, he was good looking. Okay, that's not everything, but that's a start. He was a very good looking man. But he had his brother murdered after his brother had raped his sister. And Absalom, because of that, went into exile. And he was later readmitted to the family household. And in 2 Samuel 15, beginning in verse 1, "And it came to pass after Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him." He had an entourage, we would call it. And I've dealt with a lot of people in Branson stars and people like that over the years. And one of the ways I judge them, I probably shouldn't, but some of them, the more stable ones, have an entourage that doesn't change every year. There's one very popular Branson entertainer who, it seems when I deal with him, I have to go through a whole new set of people that he hires every year, and it changes year to year to year. And others have the same people for decades, and I tend to respect them a lot more than the people who change. But Absalom had an entourage. He was a good-looking man, and it was now at one point brought back into the royal household in 2 Samuel 15, beginning in verse 14. He had those chariots running in front of him. He had an impressive entourage. I'm amazed that some of these people that I guess I shouldn't name the star, but he had a manager who was managed probably the biggest country music star in the 60s, and then later managed another big country music star, both of whom are now dead, and then was doing a third one who became very, very popular. Well, I'll mention him, Billy Ray Cyrus. Some of you may remember him. He could play the guitar, I think, right-handed or left-handed, and his big song was "Achy Breaky Heart." And I've interviewed him, and then my wife and I had our picture taken with him and showed it to my granddaughter. And they said, "Who is that?" And I said, "Oh, that's Billy Ray Cyrus." I think everybody knows who Billy Ray Cyrus is. And they kind of, okay, big deal. I said, "That's Hannah Montana's dad." "Oh, Hannah Montana's dad. You had your picture taken with Hannah Montana's dad." And that made all the difference in the world. But he had an impressive entourage. And his manager, I remember one time I did an interview with Billy Ray and set it up. And for convenience sake, I had everything set up in my hotel room. And about 10 minutes before, 5 minutes before Billy Ray was due to arrive, there was a knock on the door. I opened it up and he says, "I'm so-and-so with Billy Ray Cyrus Security. I need to check the room out." "Okay, come on in and look all around. No weapons, no nothing, and no cameras, anything like that. That would be an embarrassment to him." And he left. And then his manager, who I knew real well, came by a few minutes later and said, "Billy Ray's with me, but first, I've got to come in and check the room out." That has never happened to me before, but it was supposed to be impressive, I guess. And then Billy Ray came in. And it was, so sometimes people have an impressive entourage, as did Absalom. And Absalom rose up early, stood beside the way of the gate, and it was so that when any man had a controversy with a king for judgment, that Absalom called to him and said, "Hey, what city are you from?" And he said, "Well, your servant, him, I'm from one of the tribes of Israel, one of the same tribes of Israel." So he had that. Some of you may remember, again, I'm showing my age, but most of you are about my age, and remember the Smothers Brothers, Comedy Hour. And it was during an election year, and they had a comedian on there named Pat Paulson. And Pat Paulson was going to run for president of their little sides. It was just a joke, but Pat Paulson for president. And he would show him in California, and he would say, "It's good to be here in California. You people here are so laid back and so comfortable to be around, not like those people in New York who are so stuck on themselves and so whatever the word is appropriate. But you're not like those people in New York." And then he'd do a speech in New York and say, "Oh, it's great to be here in New York. I love you people here. You're not like those people in California. They're a bunch of flakes." You know, so this is apparently what Absalom was doing. He would relate to the average person. And, you know, "I'm one of you. I'm just a regular old guy like you. Does that sound impressive?" And he had that going for him, just like Pat Paulson did. And Absalom said, "See, your matters are good and right, and there's no man deputed of the king to hear you." You know, the king's not going to listen to you. I'm one of you. You know, let me deal with it for you. And he was more accessible to David. How would you feel if you, well, as a pastor of the church in Springfield, what if you couldn't talk to me because I was off somewhere doing something else? Well, David had a much larger responsibility, and he wasn't always available. Absalom was. And Absalom said, "Moreover, if I were made a judge in the land, every man who came to me with any suit might come unto me, and I would do him justice." You know, if I were running things around here, and we hear a lot of that on election years, don't we? Particularly when there's a presidential election. "Well, if you elect me, it'll be like this. Or if you elect so-and-so, you know, you're still going to have a president who's off there in Washington. Really, I don't care what you think." So he showed affection for the people he met. And it was so that when any man came to him to do obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him. He was easy to get close to. And he showed affection for the people he met. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And Israel and Absalom, and on this matter, Absalom did all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He became very, very popular. Have we seen that in the past? You know, in politics and entertainment, people become so powerful that they can get away with anything. And it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, "I pray thee to let me go and pay my vow which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode in Geshur in Syria, saying, the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, and then I will serve the Lord." He said that he was claiming a relationship with God. Well, that's not a bad thing. And Absalom and the king said, this is David, "Go in peace." So he arose and went to Hebron. And Absalom sent spies throughout the tribes of Israel as soon so he could hear the sound of the trumpet. Then you shall say, "Absalom reigns in Hebron." So he was amassing power there. And Absalom went with 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called and went in their simplicity. They didn't know what was going on, but they were with Absalom. And Absalom sent to Ahithophel, hope I'm saying that right, the Gileonite, I think that's right, David's counselor in the city, even Gio, and while he offered sacrifices and conspiracy was strong, for the people increased with Absalom. His numbers increased. More people were believing in him. More people were listening to him. And there came a messenger to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom." he's getting ready to take over, and in some areas had taken over. He amassed power. Well, let's look at all those things that that are. And David said to all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise, let us flee, and we shall not else escape from Absalom." So he realized Absalom was an enemy and was trying to get rid of him. "Make speed and depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword." So here you have Absalom versus David. Let's look at Absalom a little bit. He was a good-looking man. You know, a really good-looking man. He was impressive. We probably would have been impressed with him. He could relate to the average person. He wasn't way up there where you couldn't touch him and couldn't talk to him. And he was more accessible than David. You know, David, you maybe just the average guy couldn't get close to him or talk to him. He appeared to stand for the right things. He showed affection for the people that he met. And he became very, very popular and was able to amass power. And David said unto his servants, and, you know, we read that already, about getting out of the way before he comes to get us. And how did God feel about David? You know, David, Absalom, look at all those qualities he had. You know, look at that. And David said unto the servants that were with him in Jerusalem, "Arise and let's flee." Here's the question for you. Given Absalom, who was good-looking, was popular, was down with the people, cared about the people and the issues apparently, was accessible. You could talk to Absalom. You couldn't talk to David necessarily. Where would you have stood in this condition, in this circumstance? Think deeply about that. How would you have where would you have stood in this situation? Would you be with that popular, good-speaking, impressive guy, Absalom, or would you have stayed with David, who you probably couldn't even talk to, who had sinned openly and repented of it, of course, if you read Psalm 51. But how did God feel about David? And when he removed from him, he raised up to them David. This is Acts 13, verse 22. Acts 13, 22. "And when he had removed him, he raised up to them David to be their king, to whom he gave testimony and said, 'I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, to fulfill my will.'" How did God feel about David versus Absalom? He was a man after God's own heart. He'd made mistakes, but he always repented. Again, I hark back to Psalm 51. And, you know, that's how God felt about David. How would you feel? I mean, if you were just there, you're just one of the folks, and Absalom paid attention to you, you know, very popular, very good-looking man. And we see that today in entertainment. I watch Dr. Phil once in a while. I don't know if I should admit that or not, but I find some of his, well, at one point when I was drafted to be a pastor, I'd called Victor Kubik, who was over ministerial member services at the time, and I said, "I'm Don Pierowitz, I'm your interim pastor in Springfield," knowing that they would finally get somebody competent to take over. And he said, "Stop using that word interim." So I was drafted. I was drafted, and thanks to the home office and the people up there, it wasn't as tough as I thought it would be, because there was always somebody I could call and call on their cell phone, even Mr. Kubik, if I wanted to. I say that right, Kubik. We had a friend whose last name was Kubitz, K-U-B-I-T-Z, almost the same spelling. And my wife knew them, and I knew them, in different worlds before the two of us got together over 60 years ago. And I would call them the Kubitz, and she would call them the Kubitz. And I said, "No, that's not right." And I'd known them longer. My dad grew up with this guy, and so I thought I knew it. And then I asked, when the Kubitz were here for the women's weekend, I asked Mrs. Kubik, I'm saying it right. That's not the way I was saying it. Is it Kubit, Kubik or Kubik? She said Kubik. Unless you're in Germany, then it's Kubitz or Kubik. So anyway, I was wrong about that. But how would you feel about that? Who really runs the church? Is it the Council of Elders? Is it the president, the head of the administration? Exodus 3 in verse 14, and God said to Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt you say unto the children of Israel, I am he who hath sent, who has sent me. I am hath sent me unto you. So who's in charge? And God said, moreover unto Moses, thus shall you say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, and the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. So we can see here that God was in favor of David. He considered David to be the rightful king of Israel. And John 15, beginning in verse 1, John 15, 1, and Jesus came into the coasts of Caesarea Philippi and asked his disciples, who do they say the Son of Man is? And some said, well, you're John the Baptist. Some said Elijah. Others said Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said unto them, but who do you say I am? This is who people were guessing was the identity of Christ. And Simon Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed unto you, but the Father that is in heaven. That's who Jesus Christ was, you know, the Son of the living God. And he said, and I say also unto you, you're Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So we are a part of a church that is going to succeed, built on a rock, not on sand. Luke 1:76 through 79, and thou, child, shall be called a prophet of the highest, for you shall go before the face of the Lord and prepare his way to give knowledge of salvation unto the people by the remission of their sins through the tender mercy of God, whereby dayspring is from on high and has visited us to give light to men that sit in darkness and the shadow of death to guide our feet in the way of peace. So Jesus Christ is the one ultimately in charge and the one to whom we answer. Matthew 7, beginning in verse 24, whosoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I'll liken unto a wise man who has built his house upon a rock. Is your belief and your loyalty to that rock, you know, to that solid rock? And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew. We heard about that a little bit in the sermonette. You know, that happens. We have things that happen that are not pleasant, that stick with us, that cause us pain, that cause us frailty, like in my case. But still, we have to deal with it. And but are we? Is our faith built on sand or upon a rock? You know. And everyone that has the sayings of mine and does them shall be like and here's every one of these sayings of mine and does them not shall be like a foolish man who built his house on sand. New York City, like it or not, I'm a New Yorker, but I grew up in the other end of the state, closer to Niagara Falls and Toronto and places like that. But when we look at New York City, why do they have those skyscrapers there? New York City, Manhattan Island particularly, is on a rock. It's granite. It's solid. You can build on it, and the buildings are pretty safe and pretty solid. So we should have our faith in what we are built on a rock, not on sand, on a rock, on something solid, something that's just not going to change. Who's really in charge in the church? We cannot ultimately look to human leadership, to the ministry, and we've seen people who were in very high places in the ministry who aren't with us anymore. The administration, We've seen people in the administration in Cincinnati who are not with us anymore. I remember when things were in Pasadena and we were asked to pray for the people who were working out. I thought, well, they're smart people. They're smarter than I am. They don't need my prayers. And I didn't really pray that much for them because they were so much smarter than I was, so much more qualified than I was. And look what happened. You know, if you've been in the church any length of time, we need to be praying for that. We need to be praying for those around us. Look around this room. Look around the room at the feast. All whom are subject to failure and need our prayerful support. Are you supporting the ministry, the administration, those others in your chair, in your congregation and other congregations? 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 25. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 25, one of the shorter, not the shortest, but one of the shortest verses in the Bible. Brethren, pray for us. Do you pray for the administration? Do you pray for those who are living and working at the home office in Cincinnati? Do you pray for me? Do you pray for Mr. Martins? Do you pray for Mr. Ott? And, you know, these other people, are you praying for the administration in the church, either locally or regionally? Our regional pastor, I don't know if it applies here, I think so, is, I keep forgetting his name, Greg Smith. Strange name, isn't it? In Houston is our regional pastor. And that's funny. I can't remember his name, but you know, the pastor of the church in St. Louis, I don't have any trouble. He's just got a simple, plain name, Vince Simkowiak. I was there the first day he came to church, and his brother was coming to church at the time and is still with the church. But I picked him up and we drove to Buffalo, and he says, oh, there's my brother is starting to come to church today. And his car was, I found out it wasn't his car. But the car he came in was parked in the parking lot with a little statue on the dashboard. And I found out later, I think it was his dad's car. But because I saw that, I thought, he's not going to last very long. He is, I don't want to say too many good things about Vince Simkowiak. By the way, there's, I think, 8 letters in that or more in that name, Simkowiak, and only 2 or 3 of them are vowels. S-E-Z-Y-K-O-M-I-A-K. So that's easy for me to remember. And a lot of those, I was baptized in Buffalo, those people in Buffalo. So do you pray for the ministry? Do you pray for all of us? Do you pray for me? I need it. And other people in responsibility in the church. John 21 and verse 22. John 21. And verse 22, and Peter, turning about, seeing the disciples whom Jesus loved following, which also learned leaned on his breast at supper, and said unto him, Lord, who's going to betray you? And seeing him, Jesus, and Peter seeing him, said, Jesus, you know, what is this man going to do? You know, who's the traitor amongst us? Because apparently they knew somebody was. And Jesus said unto him, I will that you tarry till I come. What is that to thee? Follow you me. Do we follow Jesus Christ, or do we follow a human being and a human leader? And again, we do have human leadership in the administration of the church. Are you praying for them? Are you praying that they will do God's will? You know, if you follow the format in the, quote, Lord's Prayer, you know, one of the things is to that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And is it being done through the church? I hope you're praying for that, praying for Victor Kubik and Mark Welch and all the other people at the home office who handle various responsibilities. And to follow means to join. As a disciple, to become one of his disciples and side with his party. So are we on Christ's side? We need to look to Jesus Christ, look at his word and his example. Because not Victor Kubik, not the Council of Elders, certainly not me or any of these other human beings, but the real leader of God's church is Jesus Christ. He's the true head of the church.